It's another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast here on this Sunday, March the 29th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets No G and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. And come join me at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Sign up to get show updates for free, premium content, chat for free, interact with me, all at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks on the Believe Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. The regular season's underway. We cracked the cellophane off a new Mets team here in 2026. It's our annual first impressions show. We always do this because, as you know, and I'll say it because I have to in case you never know. Well, maybe this is someone's first time listening. From now until about Memorial Day, end of May, this is the getting to know you phase as we look at the new edition of the Mets here in 2026. We see what we like about them, what we don't like, what they need. And then, whether or not this team, by about June 1st, you'll know whether or not this team can contend for any kind of postseason spot. But there's always those first impressions. It's like meeting somebody for the first time, whether it's on a date or a sales call or whatever you might be doing, any interaction you have in life this weekend, because I don't really count spring training, especially with the WBC. We got our chance to see the Mets on a first impression. And look, it was okay. I think that anytime you take two out of three from anybody in this sport, you got to be happy. That's the goal. Every series in a microcosm, two out of three, 6 out of 10, 12 out of 20, 13 out of 20. You want to kind of keep inching forward, 10 games over 500, 15, 20. I mean, we've talked about this time and time again. So anytime you start the season 2-1, you've got to be happy. Now, I'm going to be honest with you guys here. I wasn't overly happy with how they played. There's nothing about the three games that we saw from both sides of the ball that I would say put it in a bottle, capsulize it, and let's use that potion, because I think that there was some ups and downs. I think there was some good. There was some concerning. I don't think there was really any bad, but let's just start with the team. We're going to break this down on first impression. So basically, I'm going to give you my impressions. We're going to take a break. And I got some emails, I got some comments over at the Spotify, I got some stuff on X. I'm going to try to take the best of the best here and address some of the things that you guys have on your mind. Maybe before the show is out, as I scroll, as we're talking here on this Sunday night, maybe something will come up that I want to throw in and put my own mailbag in. You never know. But anyway, they were lucky to take 2 out of 3. Let's face it. They also could have swept. I know that a lot of people are smarting over that send of Lindor. It was a little aggressive. I know that after Mike Saubaugh doing a really lousy job a year ago, this is a sensitive subject, third base coaches. I miss the days of Joey Cora where everybody was sent, and I felt that he was aggressive in a smart way. Lindor did take accountability. He didn't think he got the greatest jump there. He didn't round. I guess it was second all that great, so he knew that maybe he played a part in it. Look, I'm not going to make this all about that. They probably should have held him with the middle of the order coming up. But with Bichette's struggles, which we'll get to, and how they poorly executed with runners on third and less than two outs throughout the weekend for the most part, well, I mean, I could see maybe where the aggression is warranted. Now, I know everybody loves opening day, beautiful day at Citi Field. And look, when the ball's flying out of Citi Field in April, actually, I shouldn't even say April, March. That's how crazy it is. We've got three games, and we're going to have more games before April 1st. It's kind of weird. Usually you have a game or two before April 1st. Here, you're going to have almost a week of games before the calendar hits April. But, when Citi Field produces 18 runs on opening day, and you see some fly balls, the Pirates in particular, Ryan O'Hearn and one of Brandon Lau's homers fly out of there, you're like, what the hell is going on? Is this a homer field? A warmer opening day. You saw more of the Citi Field, a typical Citi Field April series, Saturday and Sunday. Cold, hard to score runs. Usually it's going to take a walk-off or one-run game or one big inning for the Mets to get away with it. Let's be fair with Skeens and the Mets knocking him out, which was huge. They would have probably been down 2-1 if O'Neill made some plays in the outfield. They would not have put up the big five spot there in the first inning. But on the other hand, Beatty got robbed of a game-winning hit by O'Hearn yesterday. You know, I think that, you know, Soto, not so much today. One time today, what was it, the seventh inning when he had second and third and one out, he swung at that pitch over his head. But Soto continues in big spots to be a little too aggressive. And, you know, look, they could have easily gave away a game yesterday with the bases loaded, no out situation today. Gave away a game, you know, today. Now, that's the negative. They came away with a series victory when they didn't play well. I don't think they played badly. They didn't play. I'm basically saying I'm agnostic about the team this weekend. There was a little bit of 2025. There was some good signs from 2026. Now, I think the offense grinding the at-bats and putting pressure on the opposition is something new. And I think a lot of that has to do with Polanco and Robert Jr. and to a lesser degree, Semien. And this is with them getting El Zippo out of Bichette. An awful weekend out of Bichette. Basically, listening to him talk after the game, not that it's the worst of his career, he didn't say that, but it's up there. I mean, he definitely is a little lost in the dark forest over there. I think that the one takeaway from the offense you've seen just through the first three games is that there's more depth. Remember last season, especially with Tyrone Taylor, who is a backup outfielder, but was playing every day in center, with Beatty having a more potent bat, with, you know, even Benj, who was just there. Like, Benj had a home run in garbage time on opening day. He was just there. Let's face it. It's nothing. I can't even really assess Benj because there's nothing to assess. He just was there. But when you look at this lineup up and down, it's not like there's an easy out. Now, a lot of that had to do with how good Robert Jr. was this weekend with his big at-bat against Skeens, how he his approach at the plate. And that's really positive. So I think overall the offense is something that we should feel a little bit good about, even though they did not execute all that well with runners on third and less than two outs. That's the one thing that I think ruined the whole weekend. If you had executed properly on Saturday night, probably never get to the Robert Jr. walk-off. If they had executed today earlier in the ballgame, you probably never get to extra innings. Luke Weaver would have came out and saved the ballgame at that point. The bullpen, I think, is going to be good with the Rayleigh, Weaver, Devin Williams, and Brazenbaum now. And I said it correctly for those who have corrected me in the audience, and I mean that with love. Brazenbaum and how he could come in, especially early. Right now, with starters probably going no more than five or six innings, him being early, being able to get some big outs, that's going to be big. Don't be surprised. And I've seen this before with Brazenbaum. We saw it last year, but he's pitching with conviction. He's throwing strikes. I have a feeling that maybe his stint at the minors last year, what happened in the second half, how he was totally lost. And then when that game in San Diego, when he didn't cover first base, and I kind of went off on him at that point. You know, maybe he's learned his lesson. Maybe his WBC experience is big. You know, maybe he's putting it together. You know, sometimes guys put it together later in their careers. Look at Weaver. Look at Rayleigh. Look at those guys. So that's going to be huge, and don't be surprised if he worms his way into higher leverage situations in the eighth or the ninth, or even maybe backs up on the closing situation, you know, considering that with Devin Williams unavailable today as well as Brooks Rayleigh, it looks like the Mets are going to ease that bullpen and really use all their arms, especially here early in the season, you know, knowing that they really didn't have any time off over the next week or so. So they're trying to, you know, manage things a little bit differently over there. That, you know, the starting pitching, Peralta, I don't think his outing was that bad. Win aided home runs. He went five innings. That's not what you want from an ace. I said this in my predictions. I think the thing about Peralta is he's going to be an ace on some days. He's going to go short on other days, and he's going to make you wonder if he is an ace on some other days. That's why I be careful. And I know there's all these extensions being signed around Nico Horner with the Cubs and Sean Baz with the Orioles, and everybody's calling for an extension with Peralta. And if they get a good deal, the Mets, a team-friendlier deal, and I know that'll be hard for Peralta to swallow because he already did one of those in Milwaukee, so be it. But Peralta was, and if that's a outing, that's pretty good. Peterson, you know, you go to the FX data, nothing great about his stuff. but he was able to get the outs when he needed. He got you into the sixth. And McLain, I mean, he said it himself. He didn't have a feel for the ball. He didn't locate. His stuff is great. And he goes five innings, gives up two runs. And if it wasn't for maybe some early control issues with the walks, maybe he only gives up one run. Really one big mistake that was to Lau. And I think McLain has shown with his pitches, when they move, but they move straight over the plate, you know, he could be a little home run prone, and we've talked about that. So we saw a little bit of that last year. Not much of it, a little bit of that. That's something to watch. But look, the starting pitching got them into the sixth. You'd like them eventually to be more sixth, getting them into the seventh. You don't want it to be five innings. Early in the season, I don't think it's a problem. I think the big key going back to the bullpen, especially Brazenbaum, is that, hey, you want it to be where you're not burning these guys out. And let's face it, the early on, the A-team of bullpen arms, the Raley, the Devin Williams, Brazenbaum, the Weaver, those are the guys that you feel good about. Garcia and Lovelady, not so much. Now, Tobias Myers will be interesting because he did exactly. He gave you like, and you pick which era you want to go back to because there's old generations that listen to this show. Pat Mahomes, Darren Oliver, Trevor Williams, whatever you want to name as far as a bridge arm that has been popular and successful in Mets history, that's what Tobias Myers did on opening day. And that's going to come in big because let's face it, even though they had a day off, Myers would save some bullets out of that bullpen, for lack of a better word. But Garcia and Lovelady are two guys that you want to keep an eye on. Now, and I know what you want me to get to. You want me to get to Manaea. I'm going to get to him more on the starting pitching. Now, as far as the newcomers, you know, we'll go with the easy one first. Simeon, he's a glove guy. You're not paying him to be a middle-of-the-order 30-home-run bat anymore. In a deep lineup, his glove at second base, up-the-middle defense is invaluable. I'll throw Benj in, the newcomer. I basically told you again, outside of the garbage time home run, he was there. He made the plays and left. I think, and I'll say this with Robert Jr., the arm of Benj and the arm of Robert Jr. is going to be big in the outfield because if you saw on Saturday night, a couple of times with a runner on second on fly balls, the Pirates didn't advance and it helped keep a runner on second rather than having the runner on third with less than two outs and what have you. So I think that's going to play. All Benj has got to do is hit at the bottom of the order and try to find himself. This is not a rookie that's being asked to be a savior. He is not even in the same situation as Pete Alonso. Now, yeah, Pete Alonso was towards the bottom of the order in 2019, but the Mets' offense was questionable coming into that season because you were relying on Cano, you were relying on Todd Frazier and some veterans that, you know, they were towards the end of their career. So when Pete put himself in the center of things, that was huge, and then he became a core offensive player. That's not what they're asking Benj to do. If that's what's going to have to happen for Benj, the Mets are in a lot of trouble. Benj is going to be himself at the bottom of the order, and then maybe one day, you know, later, not even this year, he'll push himself into a more prominent role in the order. Even David Wright batted at the bottom of the order and pushed himself in, and even that 05 team was probably relying on Wright and Reyes more than you could have expected for them at those ages, but they stepped up because they were special players. So we'll say that about Benj. You know, the weekend did belong to Robert Jr., his patience at the plate. You know, it was interesting how Gary Cohen used another former Met reference saying he has a little bit of Daryl Boston in him. I could see that with his, you know, kind of his posture and his body type. You know, you see the talent. You could see the talent. And I think the question is, you knew he had a great arm. You knew his defensive metrics were solid, so he's a good center fielder. He's got power. And the fact that he had the ball out on a Saturday night and that cold, as it was probably nearing south of 40 degrees, tells you how much power he has. The patience is the key. And I used this analogy when I was doing a recap of opening day over for the premium members over at Extra Innings. If you guys remember back in, oh, I think it was probably 2010, Jeff Francoeur was having this epiphany his first full season with the Mets. Now, if you remember Francoeur, talented guy, great arm, a good hitter, had zero plate discipline. That's what really did him in. He was a football player trapped in a baseball player's body. Basically had a football mentality for a baseball player. But early on in 2010, I think he had like 9 walks and 10 strikeouts that first month. And everybody said, well, he's trying to figure it out. Look at Francoeur, he had a great April. Well, sure enough, it took him another 90 days to get his next 9 walks because he morphed into who he is. Now, getting out of the losing environment in Chicago, the support that you hear a guy like Mendoza give, the new coaching staff, the Snitkers of the world and what have you, give him a chance to see, can he finally bring it all together? He's in his prime. He's not an older guy. He's smack in his prime. Having Soto kind of take him under his wing can help. So you got to be bullish about Robert Jr. If Robert Jr. is going to morph more into the guy that you saw in 2023, the 30 home run guy, totally different look on this Mets lineup. Totally different look. I still think it's a good lineup with him being more of a better version than what you saw the last couple of years in the south side of Chicago. But if he's better than that, big difference. And it takes a lot of pressure off a bench. It puts Semien in a better spot where he's at this point in his career. He's not a bad offensive player, but he's probably not much more than a slightly above league average. And you're not going to ask a lot of him. And I think that that's huge. And I think he really holds a big key for this offense because let's face it, with Talkman out, and you know, you have Jared Young, and I know they signed Tommy Pham, and Tommy Pham to me will probably at some point get a look on this roster. They're going to send him down to Syracuse for the month of April. He probably has some sort of may opt out. He's going to get a look at some point, Tommy Pham. I don't think, unless Young somehow starts hitting the ball, and historically he's been a 4A player, he's going to be here. So we'll see. And at that point, if they're asking Pham to take spots away from Robert Jr., he's either hurt or this was a, you know, a mirage this first weekend here and whatnot. Polanco, iffy at first base, makes me a little nervous, but you got to like the at-bats. Didn't exactly hit the ball great. One of the best hits he had all series was that last fly ball that died at the wall. Typical April ending, you know, ball that looked like it was going out and died at the wall. But he's working at the at-bats, even when he's not hitting. Don't know, again, is this a mirage? Is this just something they're doing because it's cold out there and they're not, and they're feeling their way into the regular season? But if I've said, I think Polanco as a hitter is going to give you more. Maybe he's not going to pop off the baseball reference page like a Soto or Lindor, but he's going to give you more, good high-level component hitter production. I like him better as a DH. I'm not saying he can't play first at all, but every day I'm not sure. I like Beatty a hell of a lot. Not that he got a lot of chances on ground balls. I'd like to see more on the ground balls with Beatty. But, I mean, Polanco just didn't look totally comfortable to me. So there's that. So a little bit more jury out on Polanco, but you got to like the approach of the plate. Now, the big conversation and where you could see an early narrative is going to come into play is the $40 million man, which is Bo Bichette. And I'll say off the bat, awful weekend. Not making a lot of contact. Looked a little lost there in the dark forest. Even admitted that. Admitted, and we've talked about this. So what's really interesting about Bichette is that he's talked about it with Soto. Lindor went through this. Beltran went through this. Piazza went through this. And we're having the same conversation this year to a little bit of a lesser degree from what we were talking about with Soto last year. Now, Soto not only left to go to the Mets and get the biggest contract in the sport, which is a big difference. He left the Yankees. So the focus on Soto is so much greater. But the New York media and the fans, when somebody comes over and gets paid, and let's face it, Bichette is replacing Alonso, not Polanco. Polanco's not replacing Alonso. In a lot of ways, Polanco's trying to replace Nimmo's production on offense and be better than Nimmo and a different component than Nimmo could provide. Bichette is replacing Alonso's production. And just hearing the fans, you know, social media, looking at, you know, who have been at ball games, fans still have gotten over Alonso. They haven't gotten over Nimmo. I mean, they're still on social media tracking even McNeil and guys that were traded for Gregory Soto. I mean, so Mets fans tend to hang on to yesterday a little bit more than I like. But Bichette has this big contract. He's replacing a popular player. He's learning a new position. And he admitted he was trying to get his moment at Citi Field. And I always say, the pressure of being paid, coming to a new team, big city. This is not Toronto anymore. He's not hiding behind Vlad Jr. anymore. He was in Toronto for 6 years. And that's gone. That's over. Now he's a little bit more of a, he wasn't a component player in Toronto, but he's more of a core offensive member here. He was very honest. Even looked like he was surprised that it took so long to get booed. So the booing start, not fair. I'm not getting into this with the Met fans and booing. I'm not going to sit here and say, because I don't think it was really, and I wasn't at the ball games. It wasn't really a negative environment. it's cold April series. I think the fans actually were pretty good. They booed a couple of times. They booed the Love Lady. They booed Bichette. Garcia. It is what it is. I'm not having that conversation anymore. The fans get to the point where they're being detrimental, kind of like they were that first week in the 2024, where they're going to the ballpark looking to abuse the team and have a self-fulfilling prophecy of losing. That's different. That's not what we have there. I think the media is going to try to make this Bichette slump into something about handling New York and booing, because they're going to have to target someone. Soto's done. They can't do that anymore. It's Soto. There's always going to be that kind of like off the field drama. The Lindor Soto thing, I don't think they're going to be able to stir that one up again. So I think Bichette's the guy. I think Bichette's the guy, and he's going to have to take it. He basically said what you saw. He was in between. He wasn't committed up there at the plate. But let me be honest, his third base was mixed. It wasn't all bad. The throws, especially on the deep behind the bag or on the run, these are tough plays for a third baseman, a guy that admittedly wasn't a great shortstop. I mean, you saw the metrics. Those are tough plays. He's going to have to learn them. But he made some good plays on the bunt today. I thought the play on Reynolds in the ninth inning was solid. I don't think he's going to be a butcher. I think there's a couple of different types of third base situations that he's got to work on. And even Keith was talking about how he was out there taking grounders. This guy, from what it sounds like, is a worker. And when you're learning that new position and you're taking on a new city, big contract, in a way, he's got even more on his plate than Soto. Because Soto was coming over, same position, everything the same except the uniform and the money, which is big because of who he was, and then the Yankee factor, and the factor that, you know, it's not like Bichette's coming over from the Yankees here and spurring the Yankees. So, look, I don't think it's anything more than let's give him time. In a social media world, in a excessive content world, Bichette's going to be a topic. He's going to be a topic tomorrow, and until he gets on a roll, he's going to be a topic. There's going to be questions about it. Don't be surprised they start comparing him to whatever Alonso does over the first few weeks. And Alonso's over in Baltimore, making it very clear how happy he is in an Orioles uniform, and I'm breaking my promise not to talk about former Mets, but, you know, I'm sure we'll get some kind of comparison at some point. So, I mean, those are the new guys. I mean, there's nothing really to dislike about anybody so far. The jury's out on obviously the kids, and you know, you got Bichette here with a little bit of a New York learning curve, which is totally normal. And the good news is he's got a couple of guys in that locker room, big-time players, top 10 positional players in Soto and Lindor who went through it themselves at this point. I basically said, when I go back, just to wrap up a little bit here on the impressions, the starting pitching, couldn't really complain about it. I don't think they were outstanding. And let's remember, cold city field, not a great Pirates offense. So put a little asterisk maybe there. But that wasn't something they were even doing last year. They were allowing bad teams and bad sub 700, 600 OPS players to beat them. So at least I guess that's a start. But with Peralta and McClain at the top of that rotation, they're going to give you good outings more times than not. And then the bullpen, I think, is a work in progress. So the big conversation, I think the big concern, if you want to talk about it, is Manaea. And maybe even more so. So it's funny, everybody's going to be talking about Bichette. And Manaea is going to be the 1B or the 2 in terms. But I think he's the concern. Because what I saw today, and I watched pretty much every pitch, not that I was glued to the TV, I'd get up and get a drink or what have you, but especially when Manaea was in there. So I saw a guy, and I don't have the Pitch FX data. I'll try to look for it in the break from the Pitch FX guys. But I'm on Baseball Savant. So Manaea is a guy who has never pitched like this before. He was straight sweeper today. 50% of his pitches were sweeper. Then it was four-seam fastball. Then it was sinker. Then it was changeup. Usually the sweeper is the out pitch. He was using it consistently. It was still his out pitch, but he was using it consistently. I saw a guy that was barely able to navigate a couple innings out of the bullpen. Granted, there was some lefties in there, so there was a bit of an advantage. Looking at it sidearm, you know, Keith Hernandez was comparing him to John Candelaria. I thought I was looking at Pedro Feliciano. Here's the problem. If he's going to be a bullpen arm, he's going to be the second lefty. He's going to replace Lovelady in that spot. That's fine. But that's not what he's here for. And I don't think that's what the Mets need. But right now, I don't know if I see a guy at 89 miles an hour, max. I didn't even think he touched 90. I didn't see any 90s on the radar gun. I don't think that's a guy that can navigate a lineup. And if you're going to have six starters, really, six starters, you're going to take away starts from McClain, from Peralta, from Senga, even Peterson. For what you saw today, you can't do that. Now, it doesn't look like they're there yet. Maybe they won't, because they have some days off baked in, and I think you have a month for Manaea to figure out. So it's not like 911 SOS. But Manaea in the postgame was talking about how, well, I've pitched like this before. And I went back, and you look at the Savant, and if you look at Manaea maybe a little bit earlier in his career, pre-COVID, that's Manaea did pitch like that. That's a league average pitcher. And look, if you're a league average pitcher in a Mets offense that could score with a bullpen where the A-team could get some big outs, Weaver and Raleigh, Brazoban and Williams, okay. But I don't know if that player is somebody that should be taking starts away from Peralta. And that's the thing. If you're going to go to six starters, he's taking starts away from somebody else. That saying whatever it may be, assuming that these guys, the other ones, are going to pitch to the level. So there's really no pathway here. Manaea is talking about it coming back. My prediction was that he was going to go down with an injury this year. And I hope any negative prediction I put out there, and I put these out there on the last show, and then I posted them over on Extra Innings. It was free for everybody, so you could hold me accountable. And maybe he doesn't have to be the pitcher that went to Driveline and started throwing in the mid-90s when the Mets signed him. And remember, I mean, a guy like Tom Glavine lived on location. Can he, if he locates, can he pitch like this? Maybe. I don't know if he's that kind of pitcher. And maybe in a league where everybody throws and the league average is like 95 when you're throwing in the high 80s, that used to not be a big deal back in the day. It's a huge deal now. It's like back in the day when, you know, 90 was hard and somebody was throwing in the low 80s, you're like, oh, he can't get anybody out. Unless it was breaking ball, breaking ball, breaking ball. I mean, remember, there are guys. I mean, Pedro Feliciano, I brought him up before. He wasn't a hard thrower. There's a lot of craftiness to him. So that to me is, out of all the things this weekend, everything was Bichette to me isn't, because he's going to hit. I mean, maybe I'm a little concerned about the third base situation. And Beatty to me at the DH, I wouldn't do that unless she really needs a blow physically, because his value in the field, and I don't know if eventually he'll be brought in. You're not there yet with Bichette where you have to bring in somebody for defense, but certainly a first base, Polanco. And I know he's a veteran. I just think Polanco's your DH. Beatty should have some spot in the field. It looks like he's going to get a shot in right field. So I'm not really worried about Bichette. My thing is Manaea was the one that concerned me. And then when you look at Garcia, who he really should be your last option out of the bullpen, not Lovelady. And I'm figuring that I would be surprised. They kind of left Lovelady out there. Not everybody was available. Raleigh wasn't available and Williams wasn't available, apparently, that he'd be designated for assignment. And he'll go on the cycle again, that stuff drives me nuts, because even Johan Ramirez, who I liked, who was with the Mets back in 2024, these guys get designated. They play for 3, 4, 5 teams throughout the year, and sometimes they play different stints with the teams. I just don't get it. I really don't. There's got to be a better way in the new CBA to allow some kind of shuttle and mitigate this kind of waiver stuff. It just makes me crazy. But anyway, that's another story for another day. So nothing really bad, nothing really concerning per se, maybe Manaea, but, you know, there's some work to do. It's an interesting, the word I would use, the 2026 Mets are interesting. Now they go on their first road trip, St. Louis, who's rebuilding but always going to be tough. San Francisco, maybe they could get some runs. They didn't score anything against the Yankees this past weekend. Please score some runs, because if they don't score going into that four-gamer next weekend, that's going to be a bear of a series. You know the law of averages says they're going to break out eventually, and away we go. So anyway, let's take a break. When we come back, let me hear what your first impressions are. Some people wrote me some emails, obviously the Spotify comments, Twitter. I'll see if I could find some Pitch FX stuff on Manaea. And away we go. So we'll be back with more right after this. All right, we're back. So going through some of the emails, some of the comments here, we'll start off with Jason. And, you know, Jason brought up a couple of things, and we'll address them. I thought some good points. Talked about Soto Lindor not having a handshake routine like the other teammates. You know, I just don't play a lot into that. I saw that video on social media. I'm not going to get into the Soto Lindor thing. I think that that was the last vestiges of a narrative that the media tried to play, and I don't think it's there. Now, if this team struggles, they'll probably try to, like, bring it up again. But right now, it's about Bo Bichette. So I think Bo Bichette is the target of the media. It'll be the target of the fans. And he was pretty impressive in his postgame, you know, with the accountability, standing before the media, having a sense of humor. Let's see it. You know, if the slump continues through the road trip, let's see that continue. But, you know, Jason also brought up about Alonzo, Pete Alonzo's goofiness in Baltimore. And again, I mentioned it slightly earlier, and I guess I'm going to go back on my word. I had said a few weeks ago during spring training, hey, or maybe even before spring training started, Nimmo's gone, Alonzo's gone, Diaz is gone. I'm not going to sit here and talk about it now. I get it. Diaz's first appearance with the trumpets, everybody's commenting, which is funny because what looked to be goofy when they did the concert a few years ago, and it was supposedly going to be a curse, and the Mets are being minor league, if another team like the Dodgers did it, everybody would love it because it's Hollywood and everything. And now all of a sudden the trumpets are cool because he's with the Dodgers. That's always going to be with a shiny new object how people are. And Nimmo hit a home run today. And look, I like Brandon Nimmo. At this point, it was a contract thing, and it was a flexibility thing, so I'm not going to get into that again. Now, with Pete, I think what's interesting with Pete and the getting, I guess he wanted to take his first Orioles hit and get it taken out of play, and I was reading there was some confusion, and all the social media things with him playing with his kid on the field, and him making these demonstrative visits to the mound. And look, the Baltimore media is eating this up. They haven't had a big free agent in a while. They stole a free agent from New York. Well, they didn't steal him. The Mets said, here, take him. And they're excited. They have an interesting team, and they're excited. And Pete is a guy that will give you copy. He's an emotional guy. He's a ham for the camera. He's going to probably go out there and hit 30 home runs and drive in 100 runs when it's all said and done. And at the end of the day, that's a really good player. It's just not a player that you'd want to give a five-year contract to. So to me, I think the interesting part about Pete, he almost is showing how he wants to be with the Mets. It's almost like he never felt love with the Mets. And I don't think that that is just for the contract. I think after that Milwaukee home run and that run in 2024, the fact that the Mets didn't really come to the table, and the only reason he was back with the Mets last year is because no other team did, except maybe Toronto. I almost feel like he's yearning to be loved, to be wanted by a fan base, to be wanted by an organization, to be wanted by the media. And I think he had it here. I mean, Stearns just didn't feel he was a good investment. And I think he's going over the top. And this will die down. And it is goofy. And is he a serious player? There were times I didn't think Pete was serious. But to me, when you hit 30 home runs, driving 120 runs, as long as you do that, the goofiness, I kind of block that out. I never really, and I don't know if that really impacted the clubhouse, but Pete's never been a leader. Pete's been an emotional guy that works well with the fans, fires people up, but that doesn't mean you're a leader. You know, he's out there being an energy guy. That's who he is. He's an energy guy. Fans love it because fans like that stuff. Professionals, not so much. So, yeah, I wouldn't say, Jason, I wouldn't say he's not a serious player because I think he takes his craft seriously. He's just a goofball. Sam, who went out to dinner before the game was over. Sam, you know, I hope your dinner was good. Hope your dinner went better than extra innings, and probably you were better off going to dinner than watching the last frustrating inning, even though it was exciting baseball. You know, Sam thinks that Mets need more from Simeon and Benj going forward. Let me address that. I think Simeon and Benj can be who they are. If Lindor is Lindor, Soto is Soto, Bichette is Bichette, and Polanco is Polanco. And I'll say this, and I said this earlier in the, on the show, the X factor, and even Mendoza has talked about this, the X factor on those two guys getting some rope there is Robert Jr. Because if Robert Jr. is bad, and it's kind of scary when you think about it, he was big this weekend. Mets don't win the series without him. If, because he's been not so great in Chicago, and he did have a hot month last year after the, what was it, the All-Star break? So maybe you're seeing it early this year. So it's scary to think, but Robert Jr. is going to play a big key in this offense being good. Now, I haven't really even brought up Alvarez, and that was interesting because I didn't bring him up earlier. Majestic home run on opening day. The thing about Alvarez, too, is I'm not so sure he's a middle-of-the-order hitter. So you got all these guys that are really going to be good down in the order with the kind of hitters they are or where they are in their career in the case of Simeon. Robert Jr. is the guy that inches himself into that six-hole. And that'll be interesting how that plays out. Now, if he's not good, you know, maybe you could put Vientos in a lineup. I mean, big hit against lefties. I didn't even bring him up. Big hit against lefty coming off the bench. It'll be interesting how he adjusts to basically a role where he's not going to get a lot of time. I'm sure against a tough lefty, he'll get a start somewhere, hopefully on at the DH spot. But I'm not really, Sam, I'm not really worried about Simeon and Benj right now. I mean, Sam brought up Manaea. We talked about that. And here's something interesting that Sam also brought up. And I know what this is going to be about. And I'm going to warn you guys, this is going to be a thing. And it's, you know, especially in a town where you need content, this is going to be a thing. And the Yankee fans are going to make this a thing. And I'll read you the exact quote from Sam here. Regarding the pitching, McClain seemed too amped up to start the game. While he rebounded, he still seems vulnerable to the long ball. He said he didn't have his feel. It was cold. The wind was blowing in on him. It is what it is. He really needs to work on his approach against lefties. That's fair. I mean, Lau hit one out. Here is the Moneyball quote from Sam. I just hope Cam Schlittler doesn't end up being a better player. Yankees fans will never let us hear the end of it. This is where there's a tremendous amount of pressure on McClain. Because now you've got the Yankees and the Yankee fan who absolutely wants their own ace. Not the ace they imported in Cole or Rondon, who's not an ace, but their ace. They haven't had one in a long time. They haven't had a homegrown ace in a long time. Jabba didn't work out. Phil Hughes didn't work out. Ian Kennedy didn't work out. They've always bought aces. Yeah, Pettit was an ace, but Pettit wasn't at the level of Cole or the kind of players they've had to import. And quietly last year, Schlittler had a really good season. I mean, a really good season. He had that big start against Boston in the playoffs. So his resume is a little longer than McClain's. And he had a great first start. I mean, let's face it. I mean, he went, you know, similar to all these other pitchers, he goes a little over five. Only gave one hit. No walks, eight strikeouts. A dominant performance against the Giants. Can't even say it's the weather because they're out in San Francisco. But I think this is going to be a thing, and this is going to be a comparison. And I'll say this to Sam and to all Mets fans. Focus on yourself. Yeah, and I know what people are going to say. Mike, you go on X and you tweak the Yankee fans. Sometimes X is more having fun. I mean, my problem is I can't help but not call out hypocrisy and stupidity. Really. I really do. And I should stop doing that because it's not productive for me because I get agitated. But, you know, that's the deal. So this is going to be a thing. Schlittler, and I mean, there's so many people's names I botch here, so maybe that's one. McClain will be a thing. I think both are really good pitchers. I think everybody, I mean, the fact that Mark DeRosa and the WBC in a national televised game gave the ball to McClain, I understand that Skeens or Skubal weren't an option, but the fact that he still went that route tells you how good the stuff is. And again, it's a bad offensive team. I mean, not as bad as they've been, but they're never going to be. Offense isn't the Pirates thing. It's pitching. They're starting pitching. The fact that he was able to navigate today in the weather conditions and with the lack of feel to only give up a couple of runs, and really, one of them was on him with the walks, and the other one was just a mistake. So, I mean, the only real contact was Lau's home run. That's pretty impressive, so. Joe Ambrioso on Twitter, at Jambro74. Mike, I hate to say it, but this is my least favorite time of the baseball season. Fans and media overreacting to everything, and it's all so insignificant. It's, look, that is, I agree, it drives me bananas here, the overreactions to certain things, and the footballization of the sport. Keep in mind, nobody's seen any competitive regular season action in months. The offseason was windy and stressful and weird, and spring training with the WBC was kind of like all over the place. And now you finally have some meat on the bone here, baseball meat on the bone. And they're going to overreact. This will normalize. This will settle. The Yankees will not go through the season just giving up one run, and Schlittler will get hit, just like McClain is going to get hit. And there will be overreactions. But maybe I didn't really make the point because I was saying that it's going to be a thing, Schlittler versus McClain. I think McClain is under the similar type of pressure that a Pete Alonso had coming off of the rookie of the year situation in the 50 home runs. Now, Pete did not have a good COVID season, and it gets disguised because that wasn't a real season. That was a tournament season. But he struggled that year, his sophomore slump. DeGrom never did, but DeGrom had tons of pressure coming back from the Cy Young. You know, same thing with a guy like Matt Harvey back in the day. So, you know, there's going to be some pressures, and part of me wonders if no matter what McClain does, because he still has to go through the league a couple times, and he is going to have to adjust. Every pitcher is going to have their bumps. Every pitcher is going to have their fits and starts. Nobody's perfect. Even DeGrom, if you remember, DeGrom went through that post-injury in 2017 where he looked bad. I mean, who could forget Terry Collins? I think it was in Texas after he got lit up, consoling him. I mean, and that was before he became Cy Young DeGrom, this another next-level guy. Even Hall of Famers like Max Scherzer have had their periods of adjustment. So keep in mind that kid's going to adjust. So I get it, Joe. I agree with you. It's kind of annoying, but, you know, we'll see how this all plays out. Keith over on the chat room. Professional at-bats, hustle, and taking advantage of opportunities are my takeaways from the Mets' first game. The Mets hitters made the Pirates work hard to get them out. I think, you know, Keith, thank you for that. They did a lot of that in the first game. I think they did a lot of that throughout the series. I think the only thing, and I said this earlier, that bothered me this weekend on the offensive part was the execution of runners on third and less than two outs. I think Soto was completely way too aggressive on that check swing. And then again, with the ball over his head today, he made up for it a couple of the times with the RBI hit earlier. And then in the ninth, he was aggressive. I mean, excuse me, the 10th, he was aggressive, but it was a good pitch. He was honing in on his pitch. And, you know, Simeon got blown away, you know, with a runner on third and less than two outs. That was just a good pitch today. There's not much you can do about that. By the way, that kid today, and, you know, I don't know much about him. I know he was out of the bullpen last year, but let me make sure, you know, let me kind of, how do you pronounce it? Was it Mladzinski? Mladzinski, right? Mladzinski. I mean, he had some good stuff. And I know at times out of the bullpen, he's been pretty good for the Pirates, but he had some good stuff today. So you know, can't really get on Simeon's case. But I do agree, Keith. You know, the chemistry looked better. The team looks to have some energy. Lindor pumping everybody up. I think they're really cognizant of that whole 0-70 going the ninth. Now, technically, somebody pointed out, because last year the Mets came back in extra innings against the Phillies to win a game. This did not count because you were tied in the ninth. I don't agree with that. They came back in extra innings. That was a tough win on Saturday night, a game that I think the 2025 Mets lose. Today was more of a 2025 Mets game. But, you know, I think that, and I'll go back, I don't think that the send, because that was a lot of other people sent me stuff about the send. The send to me wasn't terrible. Lindor took accountability that maybe he didn't do a cut or jump as well as he could have. It was a great relay, a great play on the short hop. The only thing you could say is very aggressive with nobody out with the middle of the order coming up, but it is what it is. So thank you, Keith. James wrote, why did Mendy take out Myers is the question I have on opening day. The guy was cruising through it, and I knew as soon as Garcia was on the mound, runs would score. Made him get Williams up on a day he should have sat. Now, I don't know if Williams because there was a day off since then. If he was unavailable today because of that, I don't think so, James. So keep that in mind. Here's one thing I will say about Myers, and let's, because the reason I brought this, even though this is an opening day comment, I brought this up, was that Myers, I think, is wheelhouse's 50 pitches. He was at 39, which is pretty good through three innings. And probably he could have came out, but I think once you get through that second 1.5 times through the order, he's probably a little bit more hittable, and they wanted to get him out there, and that was probably what went into Mendoza's mind. And I think that's what you're going to see. I think you're going to see Myers come in and get that, not innings per se, that bridge. It'll be pitches. So 40 to 50 pitches is his threshold at that point. It'll be interesting if you don't have Manaea show that he can really start and go through the order twice. And as you get later in the month, you wonder if they do some kind of piggyback where Myers does three innings and Manaea does three innings, something along those lines. I think you're way far away from that, but it came to my mind today at this point. So you have that. I'm trying to see if there's anything else I'm missing here. That looks like, you know, it's so early and, you know, there's not a ton out here. It looks like the general consensus is everybody wants Manaea gone. They're upset about the throw up at the plate. They like the offense. They feel better about the energy. It was interesting what I would say about today. This was your first stick to the ribs loss, right? Didn't you feel that stick to your ribs? And you know what I'm talking about, the stick to your ribs loss where it hurts a little bit. Now, it doesn't hurt as bad. If this was August, I know every game counts, especially after missing the postseason a year ago. But if this was August, this would have stuck hard. First weekend of the season, it stings a little bit, but you get over it a little bit better. So, Mets heading to their first road trip. What to expect this week? So, for those who are premium subscribers, and I'm going to throw something out there. I got some coupons, opening day coupons. I got five opening day coupons for a free one-month trial of Talking Mets Extra Innings, the Beyond the Mic Substack. It's called Beyond the Mic on the Substack because that's what it started out. But the content is Extra Innings. If you email me, MikeSilva@TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, remember, MikeSilva@TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and go free opening day coupon in the title. And tell me which email address. I will give that to you. You have 30 days of free content. I get these coupons from Substack so they can help you out. Thank you for those that do subscribe. What will we be talking about in between shows? Well, definitely we're going to be doing a short on Kodai Senga. That's for sure. So Kodai Senga is getting his first start. We have a Clay Holmes start this week. You know, obviously the Mets going into of their first road trip. We may have to readdress Bo Bichette. I think at some point I may take a look at Manaea closely, maybe do something a little quick on Manaea. But the goal will be in between shows to do 3 to 4 either a combination of written or audio shorts of content in between. Somebody asked me earlier today, will I be doing more shows? I think on off days, I might do a regular show for everybody, just a check-in show. This is more of an art than a science because I don't like just doing shows for the sake of it, like post-game shows. I want to do shows that fit like a flow of thought, a flow of content, topics, and that's how I do it. And I hope that those who subscribe to the premium content, I take your dollar very seriously. I think I always say, oh, it's less than a cup of coffee for a month, price of a cup of coffee, but that's still a cup of coffee that you deserve that I shouldn't be taking from you if I don't put out a good product. So anyway, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G, free coupon opening day, throw it in the title if you want to try out some extra innings. Hopefully you like it, you stick around, and then like I said, it's going to cost you a cup of coffee a month. One less cup of coffee, and you'll be able to get great Talking Mets premium content. All right, that's it. We broke the cellophane here off on the 2026 season, and away we go. We're now in the getting to know you phase. Over the next 8 weeks, we're going to be looking to see what this Mets team is all about. We just got our first impression, our first introduction. It's an interesting relationship. Let's see where it's going to go. You can check me out, of course, all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. And check out the new and improved talkingmetspodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, even interact with me, all at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.